Welcome back to Search and Rescue Pentagon Escape. We are glad to join us today. Right now we are going to read Mikey at 9:30 a.m.
Mikey, 9:30 a.m. We scurry through the maze of second floor hallways from E-ring to D-ring, and I can't help looking around at the worried faces in their cubicles. People are placking urgent phone calls and I catch snippets of them as I walk by. Was she at work today? I know, but sometimes you're downtown. He's a firefighter in Staten Island. I'm not sure if he'll be called in, and those were just the personal calls I heard. There were people making all sorts of work calls too, calls about force readiness, and asset deployment, and defensive postures. People awaiting orders or giving them, hoping for orders, and desperate for information. I remember what Sergeant Gensler told me about today being an auspicious day to be at the Pentagon. Suddenly, it didn't feel so auspicious. We'll have to go the long way around the Navy Command Center, Sergeant Gensler tells me. They're going to be busy right now getting reports from all over the world. We take a stairwell down toward what they call Daily Drive, the road that runs around the middle of all the Pentagon's rings so that cars and trucks and motorized carts can zip more quickly between areas. Some walkways crisscross above us, but the road is pretty quiet right now. Everyone who knows what's happening just got very busy, and anyone who doesn't yet know is already busy doing something else. This is the military's workplace, after all, and in the event of an attack, it makes sense the military gets busy. Outside, as we make our way toward the door closest to my dad's office, I glance at the sky again and think about all the airplanes flying over the United States. There have to be hundreds, maybe thousands in the air at any time. They're filled with innocent people moving around the country on vacations and business trips and visits to family and all the other reasons people fly. Do they know what's happening right now? I've only been on a plane once, two falls ago. I was with my mom in Utah, where she was working as a chef in a restaurant at one of the resorts. It was pretty cool because I got to live on the property and use the pool and stuff whenever I wanted. It was the off-season and there weren't a lot of people around, because it was mainly a place where people went to ski and the weather hadn't turned yet. I was pretty happy, because there were a few other kids there, and everyone was so nice and also, mostly, because my mom actually had a job. She struggled a lot with work because she had addictions, but she'd been clean and sober for a while, and things seemed good. I didn't know that things weren't actually good at all. This is where Sergeant Gensler is wrong. Wonder how the world works, how sometimes there is no logic to what happens. You can be living your life perfectly normally, expecting today to be just like yesterday, having a nice time at the state fair when BAM. Out of nowhere your whole life gets flipped around. When my mom got arrested again, the judge didn't take it easy on her on account of her being a mother. In fact, he probably was harder on her. She'd been separated from my dad for a while, and he had a good job on the other side of the country, and the school year had only just started, so I wouldn't miss much. It was decided by the court, the social workers, and my dad that he'd be given sole custody of me. From then on, I'd live with him in Virginia. I got flown across the country to him, and that was my only time on an airplane. I was too sad the whole flight to appreciate how beautiful the clouds looked from above, how the sky was so wide and open. I muttered a polite thanks when the pilot let me in to see the cockpit and gave me a little pin with wings on it. The whole flight crew was super nice, and it wasn't their fault I was such a downer. I hardly paid attention to anyone else in the air with me that day. And in spite of a few sideways looks at my big badge that said I was an unaccompanied minor on the flight, no one paid me much attention either. We were all caught up in our own dramas. I don't think it would have occurred to any of us that the machine flying us around could be turned into a weapon. And who could do such a thing? Who would? And how? The questions rustled around with my memories as I scanned the bright blue sliver of sky above the imposing walls of the Pentagon. Sergeant Gensler? I ask, hustling along behind the fleet-footed Marine before we get to the door going back inside. I have a question? Fire away, he tells me, and a flicker of doubt across his face makes me think he regrets the word fire after what we'd just seen on TV, the skyscrapers burning in New York City. If the U.S. is under attack, I ask, then aren't we a target here? That stops Sergeant Gintzler where he's standing, halfway through the door. He looks back at me, then kneels down so we're at the same level. I'm not, like, small for my age, but he's huge, so he kind of looms in front of me, filling my vision. This building is full of people who are working day and night to protect everyone in this country, he tells me. And that includes protecting the people in this building. I promise you, no one is going to let you get hurt. But it might not be up to them, right? I say, I mean, like, the crew on those airlines wanted to protect everyone on board, but they crashed anyway. We don't know what happened yet. But he holds up a hand to stop me. One of the first rules you learn in a crisis is not to let your imagination run away with you. I need you to follow that rule now, okay? You're a smart guy, and that can be a double-edged sword. Focus on what you know and what you can do, not on the tales that impressive brain of yours can spin out, okay? I meet his eyes, my so-called impressive brain spinning out a million terrible tales. But I take a and stop myself. I nod breathura, I tell him, which earns a smile. He stands again, leading me inside to find my dad. Eden, you seen Dave? He asks a woman in the next cubicle over when we don't find him at his desk. He's still in the budget meeting, Eden says. This his son? Mikey, I introduce myself. Eden, she says, smiling. Like the garden. Then she cocks her head at Sergeant Gintzler. Did you see? Yeah, he cuts her off. We saw. She shakes her head. Maintenance called up. They want to get into the SIF to make sure the backup servers are getting the right power distribution. Now? During this? Sergeant Gintzler asks. I don't make the maintenance schedule, she says. They can't go in unescorted. Affirmative. Sergeant Gintzler sighs and looks back at me. Looks like duty calls. You gonna be okay waiting at your dad's desk? Sure, I say, a little anxious to be left alone right now, and feeling kinda silly. Everyone here has something important to do, and I'm just standing around. I'm used to getting shuffled around and handed off among concerned adults, but that doesn't mean it feels good. I know my dad's just in a meeting down the hall, but I still can't shake the feeling that it's a crisis. In times of crisis, I get passed around like an afterthought. I'm a low priority in these moments, always left waiting for the grown-ups to sort out their messes. Sergeant Gintzler leaves me at my dad's cubicle and I'm alone again. I pull out my notebook to jot down thoughts about what this is like, the crackle in the air, the weirdly bland-looking offices where military personnel and civilians are mounting a response to an attack by unknown enemies. A historic day in a historic building, and how I'm on the sidelines of it. Watching it unfold on a dozen little screens scattered among the desks and in the break rooms. I listen to more phone calls. I need C-trip on the data centers and WTC, someone says. Bank of America's in there too, someone tells them, and the first speaker adds into the receiver, and financial data. Is someone considering the banks as the target? The Port Authority of New York and New Jersey offices. The second person hollers. Can you please not yell a list of tenants in my ear? The first person says, in a scolding voice that all middle schoolers know. They both lower their voices so I don't hear any more of their conversation. Tempers are flaring and no one actually knows anything about what's happening in New York. The tension in my dad's office is so thick I can almost taste it. I see men and women in uniform hustle through the hallways from one meeting room to another. Secretaries at the copy machines watch them pass, just as anxious and hungry for information as I am. This reminds me of waiting outside the courtroom at my mom's sentencing, before I got flown across the country to my dad. At least then, the social worker sat with me while we waited for my fate to be decided. Here, I'm alone, and it feels like the fate of thousands of people. maybe millions, hangs on what is happening behind closed doors in these meeting rooms and the hundreds of other meeting rooms around the building. I wonder what all the generals upstairs are doing right now. I wonder what the firefighters one saw outside the building near the helicopter pad are doing right now. I wonder what the people trying to get out of the burning World Trade Center towers are doing right now. I can feel my imagination starting to run away from me. This is what it must have been like during the Cold War, when everyone thought the Soviets had nuclear weapons aimed at this building. People going about their business, doing their jobs, always with the sense that death could fall from the sky at any moment. The feeling isn't doing my bladder any favors. I pop up and make my way out to the hall between candy rings to find the men's room. I catch a glimpse of a clock as I go past, 9:34 a.m. It's been, like, an hour since that first plane flew into the first skyscraper in New York. I hope all the people have made it out by now. I have the bathroom to myself, which is nice, because it gives me a chance to splash water on my face when I'm done, to try to calm my nerves. I take a deep breath, make a brave face in the mirror, and step back out into the hall to go back to my dad's office. When he comes out of his meeting, I think I'm going to ask if we can go home. I have enough info to finish my report, and today doesn't seem like a good day to be at the Pentagon anymore. Everyone is busy and I'll just be in the way. I don't want to be a kid who gets in anyone's way, who messes things up. I've been that kid before, the day my mom got arrested and I stopped myself. I really don't want to think about that day right now. Instead, I rehearse a little speech about the reasons to tell Dad he should let me go home on the metro all by myself. I'm idly playing with my visitor's badge, which I realize says that I need an escort with me at all times, but in the chaos of the morning, I seem to have been let loose without one. If someone catches me, will they think I'm a spy? Will I be arrested like the badge says? I look around anxiously. Sergeant Ginsler had said something about the badges being alarmed. I worry if I take one wrong step, sirens will blare and guns will be drawn on me. I see a uniformed soldier walking in my direction from the doorway to the Navy Command Center, and I'm afraid I'm about to get in trouble. No alarms are sounding, but he looks agitated. I figure I can avoid the trouble if I ask him for directions first, even though I totally know where I'm going. You can really take the anger out of a grown-up by asking them for help before they can ask Earth you think you're doing. You would on excuse me, sir. I call, hoping I didn't just offend another enlisted man by calling him sir like he's an officer. He stops and looks at me, frowning. I was wondering if you could. I don't get my question out, because before I can finish, the world explodes around us. When I was 8, I flipped over the handlebars of my bike going way too fast over a pothole that was way deeper than I thought. I remember how I saw the hole coming and time slowed. I felt the impact, felt myself leave the bike seat. I rolled forward, head first, doing a full flip before I crashed into the pavement and slid, my bike landing on top of me. The crash probably took 2 seconds, but it moved in slow motion. It felt like hours until the pain snapped me back to the present and the taste of my own blood made me cry out for help. This is a lot like that. Time slows so that I can see everything happening, but it also turns to jelly too thick to move through. I can't do anything about it. There's a huge boom, louder than any sound I've ever heard in my life. I feel the building shudder. The floor ripples, and my first thought is earthquake, but there are no earthquakes in Northern Virginia. At the same time I have that thought, I try to hold myself up while the floor moves away from my feet. The air behind the uniformed soldier at the end of the hall shimmers. There's a heat wave behind him, rippling like a mirage in the desert. It fills the huge hallway from floor to ceiling and my brain can't make sense of it. Did we get hit by a tidal wave? The soldier has this surprised expression on his face, and then the shimmering air around him bursts into flame, a sheet of fire that covers him completely. The flash of light nearly blinds me and the sudden heat scalds my face. Where the soldier had been standing in the door to the Navy Command Center, a blast of fire and wind punches out, knocking the breath from my lungs and throwing me off my feet. I want to shout, but I've got no air to shout with. I feel like I'm drowning in the hallway, tumbling ahead of a roaring inferno. I don't even know where my limbs are going, whether the floor is up or down. Everything's a jumble, like reality has become unstitched, and suddenly the lights go out. It's pitch black. I feel myself hit something hard, smacking me forward again. My own lights go out then. When I come to, my ears are ringing, my eyes sting, and my throat feels like I've just swallowed a can full of rusty nails. I gasp for air and barely get any. What I do breathe in tastes like ash and sulfur and gas. My eyes struggle to focus on the dim light of the hall. The light is coming, I suddenly realize, from the fire licking the ceiling above me. It's like the surface of a red-hot ocean, undulating, almost alive. Ceiling tiles drip, melting like ice cream. For a moment my confused brain wonders why my body feels cool while my face feels so hot. Am I lying in a pool of ice cream? I look down the length of my body, terrified I'll find some mangled mess of charred flesh and blood-soaked khaki pants. I even fear the shame that I might have peed myself, but what I see instead is that I'm soaked from the chest down by a fire sprinkler dousing me with life-saving water. I push myself farther into its spray, so my face and hair are wet and cool too, cleaning out the dust and debris from my eyes. The air around the water steams, asp-chawly up by the pipe on the ceiling, which is now surrounded by fire. I watch as the metal of the pipe starts to melt and bend, like in Terminator 2 when the robot made of liquid metal changes form. The sprinkler drips molten metal that sizzles as it hits the floor, and soon the water stops flowing. I can't make any sense of what I'm seeing. It's a nightmare. Where walls once were, there is now only rubble. Where the ceiling had been is flame and black smoke. I look in what I think is the direction I'd been facing, toward the Navy Command Center. I see a mountain of debris, chairs and desks and pieces of steel and concrete, like they've all been thrown around by a giant toddler having a tantrum. There are wires dangling, hissing, shooting sparks, and I'm suddenly very aware that I'm in a puddle of water. If one of those hits the water all over the floor, that'll be it for me. My body moves before my brain even tells it to. I'm up off the ground, running in the other direction, away from the wall of fire and the wires and the melting sprinkler system, but I can't stand all the way up. The smoke is too thick at the height of my head, the heat too intense. I have to duck down. I'm on all fours, scrambling over sharp edges, broken plastic, and glass. It's dark again, and the rubble shakes underneath me. I know I'm climbing up a pile of something, because I can feel my feet slipping down as I go. It's another mountain of sharp debris, and I'm pretty sure I cut my knee on it. It's hotter near the top. The air is impossible to breathe. I pull my wet shirt up over my mouth and nose to gasp through the fabric. It helps. In front of me, I feel something like the broken wall of a cubicle lying on its side. Weirdly, it still has thumbtacks in it, and in the dim light I can make out photographs pinned to it, though they're charred. The heat at the top of this rubble pile scorches my back. I feel like it might be burning me alive. I can't stay this close to the ceiling much longer. I have to get down, get low, and find a way out. I slide myself onto the top of the broken cubicle wall and shove it, using it like a sled to slide down the other side of the mountain of rubble. I slam to a stop against a heap of office furniture that's completely twisted and broken and on fire. I gasp, rolling off my improvised sled and crashing to the floor below. There, I see a burning upside-down conference table. Beyond it, I can just make out the cavernous office space I'd rolled into. I don't know where I am. The building I'd been writing a report on, the building whose studied and whose hallways I'd explored, was now map-side unrecognizable. I'm not sure I even know where the exit doors are anymore, but I think I'm pointing in the direction of C-Ring, which opens onto AE Drive, where there will be fresh air to breathe and, hopefully, people to help me. The more I come back to my senses, the more my whole body hurts. I'm in some trouble here. It feels like a year has passed since I called out to that soldier in the hallway, but it's probably been less than 3 minutes. I hear an explosion in the far distance, and at least I know the ringing in my ears didn't take my hearing away. I can see. I can hear. I can feel. I'm alive. I have no idea what's happening, but I am alive. My heart pounds in my chest. I stop to listen, to breathe. I think about the boy in Hatchet, how he wants to panic, but he has to stay calm and think in order to survive. If I want to survive, I have to think. Except, in thinking, I'm now too aware of time passing to aware of every panicked thought in my head. My imagination starts to run away from me. Did a bomb go off? Is the building under attack? Is America being invaded right now? I don't see any other people, so I start to fear I'm the only survivor. I imagine zombie movies, end-of-the-world movies, movies where I have to fight an invading army by myself, hand to hand in the flame and fire, just to stay alive. That's when I remember what Sergeant Gensler told me, the first rule you learn in a crisis. Don't let your imagination run away with you. Focus on what you know and what you can do, not what scares you, not what you imagine. What is real and what is happening right now? Right now, the building is on fire. Right now, it's getting harder and harder to breathe. Right now, I'm on my belly, looking through the dark toward what used to be the main floor of the Navy Command Center. I thought I'd been going in the whole other direction. I was so turned around in my panic, I'd actually circled back somehow to what looks like the site of the explosion. Where there had been rows and rows of cubicles and high-tech screens for monitoring ships and aircraft all over the world, there is now just chaos. Focus on what I know. People worked here. A lot of them. There's no way I'm the only one left. I have to find them. Maybe they can help me. Maybe I can help them. I find my voice and call out, "Hello." It comes out like a raspy whisper. I try again. "Hello. Anyone there? Over here." Someone screams. "Help. I'm stuck. I can't find him. I can't." The voice cracks, but even through the ringing in my ears, I recognize it. It's Lena, who I met before. I crawl toward the voice, and that's when I see what she's screaming about. Her baby carrier is blown over on its side beneath the rubble. My stomach lurches into my throat. There's no baby in it. I have to find him. Lena screams, and I forget all about the pain I'm in, or my hurt knee, or the ringing in my ears. There's a baby missing in this burning rubble, and I have to help find him, before the fire burning the ceiling kills us all. "Don't worry. I'm coming," I yell, sounding much more confident than I feel.